Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by just Dr. Adam Francisco. Not a just. This is special because I actually can't remember the last time just Adam and I recorded.
Have we ever just you and I recorded?
I know that we have.
It has to be.
I know that we have. I think last year we did like two.
Oh, yeah. I actually do remember that from my office there in River Forest.
I don't remember when what those episodes were, but we did them.
Yeah, it was one, because over the pandemic, it was basically you and your dad going through the confessions, am I right?
Yeah, we did a lot of that, yeah.
And then we all got fancy and got soundboards, and now we can connect over the ethers and get back together again.
Yeah, I mean, it broke down my stubbornness about recording in person. And I think the other thing was I no longer had an excuse because of the second podcast that I've been hosting, The Outlaw God, which is always recorded by distance. So I could no longer say, well, I don't really like the way it feels when you record over Zoom. I still think it's got problems. Don't get me wrong. Like,
sure.
You know, we've recently done episodes where it's more than just you. Like we had Dan Price and Eric and Chad and as good as those conversations come out, it is more difficult to facilitate because you're kind of guessing when people are going to speak.
Yeah.
And things like that. So, and there's technological limitations and all sorts of things. But we are here, and, you know, I don't remember what you and I recorded before when we were alone, but I would guess it has something to do with apologetics because that's the easiest to flow on.
Yeah. I seem to recall maybe an episode on Islam. That's easy for me to flow anyway.
Yes. And not saying that my dad doesn't keep up with the apologetic stuff, but the episode we're going to do today is less in his wheelhouse of the apologetic stuff, which is, I think we're going to phrase this as why you should know about the Christian response to adversity. I think that's the way I'll phrase this episode. But the bent is going to be looking at this interesting fact of how prevalent apologetics or apologists were in the early church. So we just did a Why You Should Read the Old Testament episode. We just did a Why You Should Read the New Testament episode. And in those, we listed and covered a lot of the objections to Scripture, both the content of Scripture and sort of the historical reality of those books, the authorship of those books. We touched on a lot of it. And I think that the natural thing to say is that we are not in the first era of the church that has had some sort of pushback or rejection of the content, both on sort of theological grounds for the religions around or you know, dislike or distrust of Christian theology, but also for these, we talked a lot about the moral apprehension of our time to the moral demands that are found in Scripture, both in the Old Testament and the New. And that was true for the early church as well. And so it seems to me that at any point in history, when the gospel is being proclaimed and the Christian faith is being publicly professed, that there's some sort of adversity to it. And so in the early church, you have a non-Christian world, in many cases persecuting, in other cases challenging or trying to philosophically or ethically overturn. You get this, I would say, you know, the Reformation era is a good example of this too, where a Christian world assumes the gospel, and some other errors occur within that. And then when the proclamation of the gospel sort of returns in full force, you have adversity of a actual Christian type against the gospel or from a church to the gospel. And now again, I think a lot of people, when we look at the tension and the uncomfortable nature of being a Christian right now, it's the same kind of thing, that that sort of the proclamation of the gospel and upholding the truths of Scripture and generally cause adversity.
Yeah, it's interesting. At a time like now, in the last several decades, I guess, when I don't know if you use the term apologetics yet, but
a little bit.
when a defense of the Christian faith, a defense of the truthfulness of the Christian faith, or a willingness and an ability to always be prepared to give an answer to those who would ask you for the reason for the hope within you, is crucial, absolutely necessary. You get folks out there, like, I think the name is Philip Kennison. I don't know who this guy is, but he's a theologian at some Christian college. He wrote an article not too long ago called something like, by not too long ago, I mean maybe 20 years ago, called Why There Is No Such Thing as Objective Truth, and It's a Good Thing Too. And it was in a volume entitled Christian Apologetics for the Postmodern Era or something like that, or Christian Apologetics for the 21st Century. And he argued in there, as has a fairly prominent contemporary theologian, James K.A. Smith, from, I believe he's still at Calvin College, that the church in this postmodern world is largely exempt from the apologetic task. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got their reasons for arguing that, but it just boggles my mind that anybody would take that position. There's an interesting essay by J.P. Moreland addressing this sort of postmodern Christian approach to the culture, saying we shouldn't do any more apologetics, where he says that sort of aloofness to the apologetic task in our day and age betrays the blood of the martyrs from the early church and their hard-won, if you will, like victories, you know, against adversity. Because of the first 300 years of Christianity, it was no picnic. It's certainly not true that there are persecutions going on all the time. I mean, there were some universal persecutions. I think of Emperor Diocletian, the tail end of the 3rd century, who tries to stamp out Christianity and therefore gives the order that anywhere and everywhere Christians should be rounded up and tried and given an opportunity to apostatize or to be executed. And any time Christian literature was found, it was to be burned and so on and so forth. There were times like that. There are also times like the first real state-sponsored persecution of Christians in 64 AD in Rome, you know, after Rome burns, you know, a large portion of the city burns, and everybody's blaming Emperor Nero, and Nero probably wasn't behind it. You know, he wasn't even in the city at the time. But he uses Christians as scapegoats to shift public opinion and blame on Christians and starts sewing them up. And one Roman historian tells us he would take the pelts of animals, freshly skinned animals, and sew Christians up in them, put them in the middle of where they had the chariot races, the circus, and let wild dogs and other carnivorous animals have at it. And in those times, Christians, I mean, you read some of the accounts of these martyrs, whether it's like Polycarp, the martyr of St. Polycarp, which is incredible, or there was one that we read at Irvine, I don't know if you remember it, St. Perpetua, that is, the martyr of St. Perpetua, just heart-wrenching, but also you think, man, I don't know if I'd have enough cojones to do what these folks did. But while all that's going on, you have also Christians, like in the 2nd century, this group of Christians that the 4th century church historian, Eusebius, you know, who wrote the Ecclesiastical History, and I think it's 8 books, he describes these 2nd century Christians who are living in the midst of persecution, who still found time and thought it was worth the effort and had the guts to write letters, for example, to the emperor. addressing the accusations they or their officials made against Christianity. They made arguments for the truthfulness of Christianity. They went after the silliness, if we can call it that, of paganism and so on and so forth. And I mean, that's the early church. One time I thought I might try to quantify this, but there's a large portion of the literature in the early church, so let's say the first 300 years, that is, could be described as apologetics.
It's massive. I mean, like, if you start dipping your toe in it, it is interesting how, like, there's not a quantified number in front of me, but it stands out how frequently that is the thing. And I think what also is interesting is that a lot of the claims against Christianity or the things that are posited as ridiculous are some of the same ones we have today. And in this sense, you don't need you don't need modern scientific methodology. You don't need the atomic age. You don't need progressivism to look at something like the resurrection and say that's ridiculous, right? That's some of the initial claims are like, well, you believe in a dead man, kind of mm-hmm. very interesting. You know, the target is the same, that like people don't raise from the dead. We don't need modern biology to overturn for the accusation that it's ridiculous to believe in a man who rose from the dead. Things like the Lord's Supper and baptism are mocked and attacked as well. So all of these things which today rationalistic or scientific accusations go, well, this is spiritual nonsense. It didn't take scientific progress for a group of non-Christians to look at these things and say that's ridiculous. I mean, people since the very beginning were going, well, that can't be the body and blood of Christ, or are you cannibals, right? Like they knew that things, that it was either bread and wine or it was a person, and then that they should be really concerned about their religion if it's a person, you know, kind of. And so the apologetics of the early church seems relevant today, because a lot of it is the same accusations. And in an interesting sense, as postmodernism comes in, I think more and more people, like let's say in my generation, are not making like well-informed empirical or scientific accusations against Christianity. They lean into some of this, you know, what the early, you know, post AD world is doing, which is just saying, well, that's ridiculous. You know, it's like they don't look for a biological reason why a resurrection from the dead is ridiculous. They just say the word ridiculous and let it stick. Yep. And the early church had to deal with a lot of that. And so I think there is something to, especially Christians today, American Christianity today is just, you know, ratcheted up. And some of that is that the attacks come from all angles. They come from within your family, maybe. They can be personal, they can be ethical, they can be political in nature. It can feel like the state is legislating or lobbying against you. It can feel like maybe certain individuals have more political power than Christians, and it's uncomfortable. And so there's something to remembering the fact that this is not unique for the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It not unique at any time. You know, the Middle Ages, you could say, especially after like the time of Charlemagne, so around 800 AD, we enter this phase of Christendom, or what Luther would call the body of Christians, Corpus Christianum, that you could go from Poland down to Spain and largely not encounter a single person who rejected Christianity, except for maybe you're crossing the Rhineland Valley, right? And you run across these pockets of Jewish believers. But even at that time period, there are Christians living outside of Europe, for example, in what we call the Middle East, who are surrounded by Islam. And so the church in various locations historically has always had to answer allegations or charges made against it, sometimes in a sophisticated, sort of intellectually speaking way. Sometimes it's not an apologetic response necessarily, but that's just the nature. I would argue the nature of the church is that it's in a sense called, not in like some sort of sense of a formal calling, but called to the apologetic task. That's 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared, and it's an exhortation to all Christians. And that the beginning of that letter actually addresses Christians who have been elect Christians who have been dispersed or something along those lines, as if God has sort of orchestrated the dispersion of Christians across the globe. And when you get to the third chapter, Peter says all Christians should always be prepared to give an answer to those who would ask them for a reason for the hope within them.
Part of this seems to be because the church is evangelical, right? Because the word that we have is publicly proclaimed. You know, even these churches who are being persecuted, right? They might meet in private, But the goal was never to create secret pocket societies, right? It is a public proclamation, even for those Christians who were living, like you said, during the Middle Ages in Muslim countries or in other hostile areas. The problem, the conflict is going to be because it's not something you can just secretly have in your mind. Or it's also not demanded that what you do is you find a group of people and you go carve out your own border and you just stay there forever, inside some sort of border. It's, it's a word that goes out and you really don't get to control where that goes out. And, sometimes that word is going to sow aggression. In fact, oftentimes it's going to sow a fight.
Yeah, especially in the early church. I mean, I think are we going to focus on the early church?
Yeah, we should. That's kind of the angle. There's a lot of setup here, though, because it's hard to, it's hard to sit down and just read a lot of early church documents. You can do it, but it's a different type of thing.
Yeah, very different context in the style of writing, their use of their reasoning is very different than ours today, and so on. Not to suggest that reason and logic is relative or anything like that, but the first 300 years, again, not only was it no picnic, but it was dangerous, and it makes sense that it might be a bit dangerous for Christianity. As you said, it's a public religion in the sense that it's meant for public proclamation. Christians are called to what people who study the theology of missions, what they'd call the Missio Dei, the mission of God. Christians are called to, if you will, participate, for lack of a better term, with God in his seeking and saving the lost. Though Christians aren't the ones who do the saving, they are used by God as masks of God to bring the gospel to people wherever they might find themselves.
Yeah,
and when you do that, you do that in the Muslim world, you're doing it, like, you're speaking the truth of the gospel. You're declaring, at least implicitly, that Islam's a scam. And in the first 300 years, that's what Christians are effectively, that's what people are hearing, even if it's not the words. They're hearing that Christianity is true. All these other religions, including Judaism, Second Temple Judaism in particular, are false. And in the Roman Empire, where the Roman people credited or strongly believed that the reason why the empire was so successful militarily, the reason why the city of Rome was so had never fallen and so on, is because they're so pious and they're so dedicated to the gods. And then all of a sudden you get this, what was accused of being as a new religion, saying that this is not true. Moreover, this, the pagan mythology is just an invention. That's going to not just ruffle some feathers, but it's going to cause a public backlash. So you get, it's in Acts 17, Paul's en route to Athens, but he stops in Thessalonica before he goes to Berea, I think. And Luke, who wrote Acts, tells us that, as was his custom, he goes into the synagogue and he begins to reason or debate with the Jews there. And then there's a kerfuffle, I think is a technical
term. That's a
good
word, yeah.
And the Jews at the synagogue there get upset, and they call to the city officials and say, ask the city officials to expel Paul. Mm-hmm. And I think Silas is with them from the city, because, as they put it, the men who have turned the world upside down are now here. Mm-hmm. So that's probably like 50s AD, I think, maybe late 50s. And
that's such an interesting phrase, right? Because if I think about some, like, Christians being active in the world today, the rhetoric is that we're always trying to turn things back, right? Like, we're trying to make the world normal again. The Pandora's box is open, and we're, as sort of like conservatives, politically, sure, but maybe not politically, but the job is to conserve the world into this box and to close it up. It's interesting to then hear, what did the church do in the early days, it didn't put the world back into a box. It turned it upside down from where it is when it's left to its own devices. Like this, mm-hmm. this chaos, this all this thing, all the things that Scripture would identify as unethical, against the will of God, harmful to fellow creation, harmful to the creation as a whole, bad for your neighbor. That's what just happens when God is not actively intervening, right? Mm-hmm. That's yep. what the spiral of sin does. And what Christians do is actually turn a sinful world upside down.
Yep. Yeah. And there's other ways of describing it too. Because from a historian's perspective or a political scientist perspective, when you talk about turning the world upside down, you're talking about a revolution. You know, and while Christians aren't political revolutionaries, they are in a way theological revolutionaries in that they're calling into question the false idols of every particular age, whether it be the pantheon of Greco-Roman gods or the false god of Islam or the false idolatrous ideologies of 21st century America or whatever it might be. Christians are not called to complacency.
Yeah.
I don't know that we're called. I know we're not called to circle the wagons, as you said, and create our own borders and keep the boogeymen out, but rather we're called to go out.
Yeah.
To even though we've been set apart from the world, we're still in the world.
Yes, there's a certain type of living that we'll maintain and living as somebody whom God uses to be a public proclamation of the word. And so that's going to have some conflict. So who are there some like what are the best examples or maybe best individuals to get a sense of some of the response to the church or from the church in a world of like ceaseless accusation?
What are some of the responses?
Individuals we could, say this is a good example to look at of the early church's response.
Well, that's a really good and kind of far reaching question. I'm gonna say probably the one to look at that would maybe bear the most fruit would be somebody like St. Augustine. But he's late 4th, early 5th century. He just wrote so much, and his stuff has been preserved well, relatively speaking. But if we go to the earliest church, so Eusebius, that church historian, he identifies 2nd century and 3rd century church fathers as apologists. A lot of what we know about these apologists comes from Eusebius, because most of the writings of these folks, like Quadratus, is oftentimes seen or regarded as the first of the apologists. We only have one little paragraph that's from this presumably fairly lengthy tract he wrote to the Emperor Hadrian, and it's just a quotation from Eusebius. But if you're looking for somebody that early, the most famous and probably also the most fruitful would be somebody like Justin Martyr.
Right.
Who, he died or he's martyred in 160, 165 or something. But he wrote two apologies to two separate emperors. He wrote a work called A Dialogue with Trypho the Jew. If you want to see the gamut of early Christian apologetics, you couldn't go wrong reading those three works. But it's not just for a historical interest. There's a lot of it's will sound a little weird and odd to us, it's from 21st century perspective. Like, for example, Justin Martyr has this concept of the Logos Spermaticus, that the Logos that John refers to that John equates with Jesus in John chapter 1. Justin Martyr says that word, that divine reason, has been implanted everywhere. And so people will recognize the truth of Christianity almost intuitively. For example, he says you can see evidences of the truthfulness of Christianity. For example, if you look at the mast on a ship, it's in the shape of a cross. There are quirky things like that, but overall, the certainly the posture of it all, because it's these apologists, they're not just tearing down their opponent's worldview. They're more interested in arguing for the truth of Christianity. They are polemical when they need to be, but mostly they take a positive approach rather than just thinking that if we just rip to shreds this pagan opponent, the truthfulness of Christianity will be obvious. Well, they actually will give evidences for whether it's from fulfilled prophecy in the Old Testament, if it's relevant for that particular context, like in the context of Judaism, or what we might call very generally historical evidences or evidences for factual evidences for Christianity's truthfulness.
One of the things I remember from some of the reading I've done of Justin Martyr is that in things maybe it's the first apology that he writes or something, there are sometimes just simple explanations of what Christians do or believe, and those are included in an apologetic. So there's a sense in which sometimes, and this could be interesting to explore today, where it's almost like he's doing systematic theology not for Christians, but it's for non-Christians to explain what Christians actually believe. In plain language or something like that, because it's being misunderstood by by pagans and by things like that, right? Like some of the, I know that he responds to accusations that Christians are atheists is one of the early accusations, right? And so now that would be a strange one to get today, but there are lots of claims about Christianity all the time that, you don't have to tear down the opponent's worldview to simply offer a corrective from a systematics perspective. And so, the prevalence of systematic theology today is simply to sort of correct or combat other Christians or establish your tradition's interpretation of something, not as frequently used in discourse with non-Christians, which is interesting, right? Because there are concepts in the world that people sort of believe. A lot of people appeal to mercy and forgiveness and love. And if there's a particular use or defining characteristic of that Christians have, those people are actually borrowing from and don't realize that, like, a society with forgiveness ingrained in it is a society that has Christianity in its DNA. There's some sort of operating problem with your definition if it doesn't include the consideration that forgiveness, can't be self-forgiveness, right? Or something like this. Like that's not, you need a new word because this is actually something greater. Or an explanation of what happens on Sunday morning, Justin Martyr explains parts of the liturgy to the world. Yeah. Nowadays, I think the response oftentimes is to say, "Well, we don't need those sort of ancient rituals and liturgy. We just read the word to each other," kind of thing. It's like, well, the early church actually just explained what they were doing, like what the worship actually was accomplishing, instead of saying like, well, worship is just styles and this one appeals to this group of people and this one appeals to this group of people. There was the reasons that you would make an appeal for were not just to other Christians. It's not like, well, you should stop worshiping in contemporary worship services and come to a liturgical service. It's actually just explaining what Christian worship is to a non-churched world.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think maybe for our listeners who kind of read some of the same stuff that we read, a modern parallel would be the second half of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, where he just gives a certainly not polemical, and it's by no means detailed, but an explanation why Christians do the things they do, believe the things they do, and hold to a certain type of general ethic, And, you know, in the early church, regarding, like, for example, communion, one of the, I think you alluded to it earlier, one of the charges was not just that Christians were atheists, but they were cannibals because they were eating the body and blood of Christ, right? And a lot of those charges that seem really silly are arose from a culture where Christianity was, even though it would proclaim the gospel publicly, it was still getting started, and churches were largely aloof of culture. They weren't, you know, sometimes they were, you know, meeting in height and, you know, trying to stay hidden so that they wouldn't be, you know, thrown to wild animals in some stadium somewhere. But more often than not, the churches, because it's so young, it's not out front necessarily in culture in its totality. It's out front in terms of the proclamation of the gospel, but it's not doing it. There aren't big public churches in the early church in the city of Rome, for example, you know. So people don't have access to Christians, and it's the apologists who are going to give them access, and they're going to do it in a way that's very different than, like, you gave the example of systematic theology, where it's just a bunch of theology wonks arguing with each other over the right interpretation of Scripture or what have you. They're doing it. I like the way you put it there. They're doing systematic theology for non-Christians. That's a pretty good description of it. Don't get too big of a head, though.
Thank you. I was going to say, some of the most, you know, like the most fruitful apologetic conversations I've had are actually not the ones where somebody is arguing like the evidence or the science with you, because usually both parties already believe why their reasoning is sound. A lot of it is actually if you can get somebody just having a conversation with you, and in our case, sometimes that's easy because you'll be sitting somewhere and somebody will ask you what you do for work, right? And then you can just tell them that you basically do Christian theology publicly, right? And if you can get them to ask questions about like a systematic topic or a topic of what happens in a church, like if they say, oh, yeah, I grew up in a church and, you know, we did this and I never really got it. You know, if they can say like they never really got why, you know, they had the Lord's Supper, man, that's, you know, you might not view that as an apologetic opportunity, but if you can just like very calmly explain not just that the Lord's Supper is the body and blood of Christ, right? But like why and what that accomplishes, you get interest, like a lot of times, because I find that people who haven't been churched for a long time or unchurched will go, oh, so you think that that actually like forgives your sins. Yeah. It's not just some ritual, right? Like they have a hard time connecting. Like a lot of the world knows what the rituals are, but they don't know what we believe the ritual actually accomplishes besides being a good Christian and doing what you're supposed to do. And so if you can get to those conversations, or, you know, I recently had one with somebody who is, you know, I now agnostic or was churched, but knew enough about Lutherans to ask, like, what was the difference between Lutherans and an evangelical and like, and stuff. And so then you have this opportunity where, you know, I talked about justification, but you're not just telling them why evangelical justification is wrong. You're just making, just tried to as plain an argument as you can about why salvation comes by grace through faith on account of Christ alone. And that's it. And like not make this whole negative argument. And that interests people. You can see somebody go, when you actually just sort of lay out a doctrine. And a lot of the early church is establishing public doctrines. And we see that as it transitions from a persecuted church that's doing apologetics to a church forming creeds. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
So you have, so Justin Martyr's a good one to read. Is there anybody else? You said you move into Augustine. That's a couple hundred years later. And Augustine is usually, you know, associated, like what we were talking about, with systematic theology. Is there a sense in which he can be like called an apologist?
I think absolutely. If, I mean, there are two works by Augustine that are still widely read. One is the Confessions, which is sort of like, I guess you could call it a spiritual autobiography. It's you know, it's a great read. The City of God, which is something like, it's 22 books in length. It takes up, like, the most recent translation that I got is by Cambridge University Press. 900 pages, I think, in small font. It's massive. So it's 22 books long. And that work is absolutely a work of apologetics because it addresses a particular thing. So he starts writing it in 413 AD, I think, if memory serves me correctly, 3 years after some thugs from the north, you know, like Germanic tribes made their way down. They were illiterate people and ransacked Rome. Now, Rome, even though they're, as Augustine will show in his work, there were instances where Rome was weak. For example, when a fire broke out in 64 AD and other times. But most Romans believed, even up until Augustine's day and age, the reason why Rome had stood so strong against foreign invaders and so on is because its devout attention to the gods in public sacrifices and other sorts of religious activity. So when these backwards thugs from the north sort of, in a way, kind of trounce into Rome and just do what they want by desecrating temples and raping Vestal virgins and so on and so forth. The big, what we get in the background before the City of God is people start asking the question, how could something like this happen?
And there's the answer, religion on the block.
Yeah, and I mean, Constantine and Theodosius in the late 4th century have been at work in legalizing Christianity, and then by the end of this 4th century, Christianity is the state religion, if you will. It's sponsored by the state. That's especially the case in the East. When in the West, there's still large holdouts of paganism, especially in and around the city of Rome. And so there are these sort of pagan apologists, if you will, who seize the opportunity and they say, well, the reason why Rome was ransacked by a bunch of knuckle-draggers from the North is because we've turned our backs on the gods, because we're increasingly becoming Christian. And so Augustine's asked by several of his friends to write a response to that, because apparently that it was causing such a ruckus in and around Rome that recent converts to Christianity are going back to their paganism. Mm. So he decides he's going to respond to the charge by writing a 22-book-long book. Starts in 413, finishes, I don't know, about a little more than a decade later. The first half of it is his assessment of this claim that Rome is weak because the Romans are becoming Christians. And he basically takes that, I mean, if we can summarize a very long portion of the book in a few words, it's basically a negative attack on paganism. He goes through every piece of pagan literature or pagan theology he can get his hands on, whether it's actually written or he's heard, and shows how irrational and incoherent and made up the Greco-Roman tradition, a religious tradition, was. Then the last half, the last 12 books of The City of God, are his positive case for, we might call it, a Christian worldview, where he describes in detail the history of God's revelation, what it is Christians believe. There's even, I can't remember which book it is, but where he gives evidences for the truthfulness of Christianity and so on and so forth. So people who spend there are scholars out there, believe it or not, who will spend their entire career studying the City of God. That's how big and significant it is.
Yeah.
And they will absolutely put it in the category of a magnum opus of Christian apologetics.
Oh, that's...
So I would count him as certainly an apologist.
Yeah, that kind of seems to maintain with this this theme of, like, there's a certain extent to which doing public theology and outlining what the church is and who it is really does stand as this apologetic purpose. It is striking to me too that as you're going to go after other religions, paganism, if you're going to focus on the manufactured nature of these, and today we would, I think often we would point to like the manufactured nature of like some of these new ethics or new spiritualism.
Some willingly admit it, like think of Scientology. Yes. L. Ron Hubbard was interviewed, what, in the 50s or 60s?
Yeah.
And he says, hey, you want to make $1 million? The way to do that is to start your own religion. So he starts his own religion.
Manufacture it, yeah. And just how much then Christianity has to rely on an argument for who Jesus is if other religions, other worldviews, other stories are all manufactured. You have to have a reason why Christianity was not made up by a guy. Because if what the flaw with every other religion is, or other every other ethic is that it comes from men always, and that that person who made it up is fallible, you have to have your source be not a man, not just a man. And mm-hmm. so then even things like internal infighting about who Christ is amongst the early church that leads to some of our creeds is important from this public apologetic perspective, because if he is a person, you know, just a man, not the God-man, then it is also a manufactured religion. And mm-hmm. now we're simply down to arguing whose ethics benefit Rome the most.
Yeah.
In which case, those pagans might say, we were a stronger nation when it wasn't Christian ethics.
Yep. And, you know, these early apologists, they'll do that in at least two ways. One is they will argue for the antiquity of Christianity, because Christianity was being accused of being started in the first century, right, by Paul or whoever.
Yeah.
And they'll argue, like Eusebius does, to refer to him one more time, he says that all the patriarchs and prophets in the Old Testament were in fact Christian, if not in name. You're arguing that this goes way back. It just depends on what side of the incarnation you're on, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of how much detail you have of the faith. And then, of course, the second point is that this is a religion based on revelation, but not some Gnostic revelation, you know, some secret hidden revelation given to some charismatic figure who requires his followers to take some sort of oath to keep this all a secret, but rather a public revelation. As I think Paul said it wonderfully before King Agrippa in Acts 26, when he's accused of trying to persuade King Agrippa to become a Christian. And Paul says, I wish everybody would become a Christian here, because as the king himself knows, these things I speak about, namely the crucifixion and especially the resurrection of Jesus, did not happen in a corner. These are real historic events.
Yeah, you've heard about it before I showed up, Pete. You know.
Absolutely, yeah. And vindicating that Jesus was not just a man. He was fully man, but he wasn't just a man. Just like it's not just Adam on this show. but rather he's otherworldly too, if you will. He's also God.
Right.
Fully man, fully God. And if God says something, that settles it. And the Greek philosophical tradition, I think we've quoted Plato before from Phaedo, who says, if there was a theou or logou theou, a word from God or a revelation, that would settle all disputes over things. The Greek philosophical tradition didn't think there was a word from God in that way. But Christians come around. It's almost like John is picking up on this logos theme, saying, he's not saying this, but this is me, you know, kind of putting words in his mouth or ideas in his head, that the logos that the philosophers long wished for but had rejected or given up on has made an appearance.
And he's
dwelled among us.
And it, if you follow those words from Plato, if it is the answer to all these things, it brings an end to all other traditions, the Greek philosophical tradition, all these other searchings.
Yeah, and that's to refer to another apologist there's actually a couple more that I think are worth reading just for historical knowledge, but also they're fun to read, and theologically they'll stretch your brain a bit. Tertullian, a debate kind of raged in the age of the apologist that asked the question, what does Jerusalem have to do with Athens? Or another way of putting it is, what does philosophy have to do with theology? And Tertullian is oftentimes, I guess, castigated for saying nothing really. Because if you have the revelation, what more do you need? You don't need a philosophical system
because
you have a word from God.
Yeah.
And that's how what Tertullian was saying. He wasn't saying, I don't think, that you should just simply shut your mind off to the rest of the world. He's just, I think what he's saying in his context, late second, early third century, that we have a revelation from God that's definitive and final.
Need to acknowledge that philosophy is always speculative.
Yeah, that's the point, is that I mean, he doesn't say this, but go ahead and read philosophy or whatever, but don't think that you're going to get a system or a set of beliefs or doctrines that's truer, if you will, than what we find in the biblical text. So.
Yeah. Well, great episode, Adam. Just in time. Anything anything else? The translations of Just a Martyr are obviously pretty easy to find on Amazon, so I'll link something there. Same with City of God, though. Like you said, City of God is if you commit to the whole book, it's quite a task.
I once when I was teaching at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, there was a course called Historical Text, and like a dope, 2 months before the semester or the quarter actually began, I said, it'd be great to read the City of God. And then I was like, what? So for, I think these were 10-week quarters, we read through the entire City of God, but man, oh man, was it difficult.
Yeah.
They do have abridged editions out there, so they're quite helpful.
Yeah, okay. Well, will you find something for the show notes there? Thank you for listening to this episode. If you would like to support the Thinking Fellows or the other podcasts on the 1517 Podcast Network, you can go to 1517.org/donate. We greatly appreciate those who support the show and the other efforts at 1517. If you've listened to the Thinking Fellows and you're looking for more material like this, you can just go visit 1517.org. Over there, you'll find daily blogs, preaching helps, other podcasts, video series. Just a lot of material. And if you enjoy or find Thinking Fellows useful, I bet you will find something else over there that you would like for personal use or maybe use in your congregation. Thank you for listening. We will catch you next time. Bye.